Welcome to the Brexit podcast, everybody, and welcome to our 100th episode. Blimey, that went fast. Like Michel Barnier and David Davis over a genial Sunday lunch, it's time to crack out the bubbly in celebration. I'm your founder and co-host, Tim Hemming, and I'm here with my fellow co-host. How many co-hosts can you have? Jennifer Hahn. Jen, 100 episodes.
And just about a year as well. I looked it up. The first episode went live on like the 30th of August. So it's been about a year and 100 episodes.
Yeah, two a week.
It's a pretty good accomplishment.
You did well to work out the math.
Thank you very much. I'm very impressed with myself.
It's a year that sped by.
Yeah, I think a few like very dedicated listeners might still remember that we did a few more personal episodes like in the very beginning. But we thought that it'd be quite interesting, maybe for a few of you new listeners, and there are a couple of you, that it might be quite interesting to hear a bit more about us as co-hosts and how we found the podcast this far. So for our 100th episode, we're getting you a bit more of a personal take on the podcast. Isn't that right, Tim?
Yeah. We thought we'd have a look back at some of the episodes, what we've learned. And some of the things we've hopefully enjoyed and taken from it. So it's going to be a whistle-stop tour through some of the shows that kind of stood out for us personally. And before we start all of that, though, Jen, have you enjoyed it?
I have really enjoyed it. I think this is going to sound rather cheesy, but I think my favourite part about it has literally just been getting to talk to people that I find interesting. It's sort of just an excuse to email people and be like, I think you're interesting, I want to talk to you.
I had that. That and was my get, one. Yeah. I was going
to... Were you?
Yeah, that's exactly what I was going
to
say.
You asked me and I said it first, so you're going to have to deal with that now. What did you enjoy, Tim?
You stole my thunder. Yeah, so the other one that I had, the realisation that the more that I start to know about Brexit, because I'd never pretended from the outset that I was an expert, but the more I'm sure there, who needs experts, Jen? But the more I know, the more I realise I don't know, if that makes sense. And we've had some incredibly confident people on the show who have been very clear and adamant. There is one episode that I want to pick up on in a minute on this, but people are incredibly confident about their own views. So we've talked about views being somewhat entrenched, but I suppose that having that confidence does make sense when you're focusing on a singular topic. You know, if you focus on one issue that's dear to you, for example EU citizens' rights in the UK, then in terms of your debating position, it makes things a whole lot clearer. And just actually this past weekend I took a trip to the Imperial War Museum and I was testing an immersive audio experience which centred on the Syrian conflict. And one of the take-homes from it was that the more confusing any issue, and let's face it, Syria is a confusing situation, the more eventually we switch off, because concentrating is difficult. Right.
Yeah.
So, and I think that's we've talked about Brexit fatigue over the past year. I think that actually happens to quite a lot of people. So, I guess it's no surprising, and it's another reason we keep the shows relatively short.
Just so we keep everyone's attention span. Yeah.
Okay. So, what we wanted to do was look back. I think we're going to pick sort of four shows or four topics around the shows today. So if you want to kick things off and pile into the first show that you've picked out, I'm going to do mine slightly chronologically. Are you going to do chronological as well?
Yeah.
Excellent. Okay, so what was the first show, having a flick back through the past year, that's piqued your attention?
Well, I think quite reasonably that would be the first episode I ever recorded for the podcast, which was episode 3, and it was with...
And was that your first ever experience of podcasting?
It was, yeah.
Wow, nervous?
Very first time ever. So nervous. You can hear it as well, bless my poor soul. Before every sort of she'd answer... Oh, sorry, by the way, the guest name is Shazia Awan. And every time she'd answer a question, I'd be like, and then ask the next question. Just, and then I already started my trend there of just beginning questions with, I'm curious, da-da-da, which if you listen back, that's how I start a lot of my questions for some reason. I'm a very curious person. I think it's a reasonable thing to say.
You should underline it every opportunity.
Yeah, but anyway, so that was episode 3, and apart from, you know, changing the music, which, as we touched on before, I think was necessary, I really wanted to bring a sort of different voice to the podcast, because the two previous guests had been white and male, and obviously you as my co-host are also white and male, so I wanted something quite different, and I found Shazia, and she's so interesting. She's a Welsh Asian businesswoman, she's a former Conservative parliamentary candidate, and she received horrible racial attacks in the days after the referendum, so I just thought she sort of encompassed everything that I wanted to touch on with the podcast, if that makes sense. So I think in a way she very much represented my interests, obviously, in sort of representing the views of more marginalized groups in society, but at the same time I think it also sort of went against my personal bias, if that makes sense, because I'm quite left-leaning, and the sort of stereotypes of conservatives are obviously that they're sort of old white, mainly men, that sort of teeter on being a bit classist and racist at points. I thought it was really interesting to bring in someone that represented the complete opposite of that, and someone that I empathize with, but someone who has completely different political views than me as a conservative parliamentary candidate. So I thought that was really interesting. And I think it's really important now more than ever, really, to sort of give a personable face to the other side, because there's so much sort of polarization, as we've talked about before. And now just recently there was like a leak of a group, like WhatsApp group chat from a young Tory group, where they sort of talked about working class people being like vermin that they think needs to be gassed. And obviously I'm not excusing that. That's a horrendous thing to say. I would never excuse that. But I think the way that's then been taken up in a lot of the left-wing press of like, all conservatives are like this, is really not helpful. So I really think in retrospect, episodes like this are really interesting, and in that they sort of give a more detailed look at what a party's like, other than like the broad strokes that are generally applied to that. So I think really it sort of summarizes my aim with the podcast, with this one episode, to really focus on, you know, people and their stories and how they experience Brexit, rather than like the economy or immigration as these broad policy issues. So
it would make sense, yeah, that you, if you actually take time to listen to somebody like Shazia and maybe listen to the whole podcast, and what episode was that? That was episode 3. That you can get a kind of rounded picture rather than taking it in soundbites.
Yeah, it was a bit of a shame, really, because it was one of our first episodes, so barely anyone heard it, because we didn't really have an audience back then. So if you are interested, please do go back and have a listen, because it's a really good episode, if okay. I do say so myself. What about you, Tim? What's your first one?
Okay, very, very different. We're going way out west. And this was episode 39, and we had a local journalist from Cornwall, Graham Smith, who he actually launched his own newspaper down there, Paid for Journalism, which is online, which is almost an unheard of thing these days. But we got him on to talk about the situation in Cornwall, which was Cornwall as a whole, as he described, is actually a poorer per head than Poland, for example. And they get a lot of EU funding, and yet, pretty much en masse, they all voted to leave. So what we had was a situation where a lot of people go down to Cornwall to retire and had made their money, and therefore that was the prevailing attitude, that they were better off out of the European Union. So with that, that was a particular situation, I suppose, a particular demographic, which led to a particular voting pattern that you would have actually thought, as a net recipient of so much European money, that it would have made a perfect sense to remain. And also then really not going to be top of Westminster's priority, Cornwall, as Graham partly pointed out. So we had that one situation. Then it made me think about a few other episodes we've done, where we had specific kind of micro populations that have been affected by the Brexit vote. So we had Paul Gleeson on in episode 53, who's a Labour councillor from Boston, and he was explaining how there, that Boston was the biggest vote leave area in the country, and he was saying how surging house prices, how multiple occupancy, because quite a rural location where you're having a lot of migrant workers coming in, the wage erosion, and you had a disaffected local population, and they'd all decide, or many of them had decided to vote leave. So there was another different situation. And then contrast that with, for example, in episode 57, we had Joe Duggan on from, who was a journalist working out in Gibraltar, saying where, I think that was something along the lines of 98% voted Remain, because they desperately need the links with Spain, because there's so much, on a daily, hourly basis, there's so much trade that goes across that border there. And then even more recently, we had Blondal Clough, who is a representative, she was in episode 97, a representative of the government of Anguilla, and she is talking about if there is a hard Brexit, potentially Anguilla could be out of drinking water, because they rely on St Martin, which is a French dependency, to get the fuel through, which desalinates the water, and then they can all drink. So, and I suppose we could extend this to Northern Ireland. We've had Conor Devine on the show a few times talking about the situation in Northern Ireland. And we have, in it, all it does, what it does, I think, is just explain how incredibly complicated this whole issue is, and the fact that when people are voting, they're voting for very personal reasons, and it's very, very different for a lot of people.
Yeah, and no one, I think, in especially in mainland England and the UK, really expected all these contingent experiences, because no one ever really talks about it. Like, I bet you that half, I mean, I don't want to generalize, but I think a lot of people don't even know that Anguilla is still part of the UK. Had you heard of it before this had come up?
I mean, I had heard of it, but primarily probably because I've heard of it is through my sporting journalism.
Right, so okay, but I just feel like...
athletes from the Caribbean.
I'd definitely not heard of it. I'm obviously not representative, but I could imagine that a few other people also haven't, and that if they had, they didn't think that Brexit would have a particularly different effect on them than it would on the rest of the UK. But obviously, all of those contingencies weren't really taken into account at the time.
I mean, it's, you know, there's only 15,000 people that live there. Blondel says a lot of times it gets mistaken for Angola, which is, of course, in Africa. And the voice of 15,000 people in amongst millions in this whole debate can easily get drowned out.
Yeah, but I think that's sort of where the podcast comes in a way, because although it's a small number of people compared to the entire population of the UK, that doesn't mean that their experience doesn't matter and that their stories don't matter and that the way this is going to affect their lives is inconsequential, because it's not. And I think that's really where we come in and where we're able to sort of give that platform, as I mentioned earlier. Okay, so for the second episode, I picked out episode 9, which is the interview I did with Gina Miller. And I know that now everyone knows this name, but at the time, this was sort of a mere couple days before the first court case in which she took the government to court over Article 50, and basically saying that Theresa May shouldn't have the right to use the royal prerogative to decide anything about Brexit, really, and that she should have to go through Parliament, and that that's the correct democratic process. And then obviously she went on to win that case, but at the time, yeah, as I said, no one had really heard of her, and I'd just read, I think, an article in the FT about how she was one of the main claimants in this case, and I just thought it was such a brave thing to do, really, especially in such an already tense political climate. So I just really wanted to get her on and talk about it. And I think right after, her profile really blew up, both in a good way and in a bad way. So there was a lot of support for her and what she was doing, but there was also so much hate, and people were berating her online and even through letters and things like that, about her race, her income, her gender, everything. And I'm really glad that we were able to sort of bring her on before all that happened to give her a platform to really make her arguments, which I really thought she brought across really well and were really intelligent and well-phrased and well-rationalized, obviously not rationed. And I really think this is a strength of podcasting as a medium. This sort of long form, unedited talking doesn't, you know, distort the views of the person talking, and it's unmediated, so you're really hearing it from the horse's mouth, if you will. And I really think sort of that's why also this was the first episode of ours that was picked up in the mainstream media. I think it was in the, I want to say like the Washington Post and the Independent or something like that.
That they shared
it, yeah. And I think that's because it was literally, I think in all the articles that were written about her, obviously you take bits of quotes and then write around it, but we literally just let her talk and let her share how she felt about things. And I think that's really valuable and such a cornerstone of what I think the podcast should be as a whole, sort of giving a neutral platform for people to air their opinions, especially when they're, you know, receiving hate elsewhere or aren't being heard properly. And I think she also mentioned in this interview something that I still think is true, which she thinks the choice in the referendum shouldn't have been remain or leave, but it should have been more nuanced than that, sort of including maybe a distinction between a hard and a soft Brexit, because, you know, that vagueness of that initial question has now led to so much trouble further down the line, where yes, we know that people want to leave, but we don't know under what terms and under what specific circumstances. And that's just, I think, part of the reason that the negotiations are going so terribly now. Not obviously the entire reason, but a big part of it. And then I believe you talked to her for episode 54 again as well. I don't know if you want to talk a bit about that.
She came back on when she was again challenging the government in court. That was again to do with Article 50.
Yeah.
And I remember Gina's telling me about her own personal experience, how difficult, how challenging it had been after she first came to, she came more into the public profile with that initial court case. And it did sound particularly quite harrowing. I think she does tend to be quite a polarising figure. I think people are quite potentially cynical of her motives at times, because they can't, you know, she's talking about wanting to go through proper parliamentary procedure, and people are thinking, is this the real reason that you're actually doing this and pushing this forward and spending just, all of this money?
Because it doesn't sound like a very interesting reason. It's like, I feel like people want a scandal. They want something like, she wants to destroy our democracy, rather than like, she really enjoys, you know, bureaucracy and going through the right procedures and stuff. So it just doesn't sound very interesting. So I feel like people want to like dramatize it.
I think it's difficult for people to really understand, and they just see her as a big pro Remainer.
Mm.
And I know in terms of a pro Leave perspective, the vote has been done, it's finished, it's time to get over it. And they just saw her in meddling, wasting more time and trying to disrupt the process as a whole. Sure, it's not going to be the last we've heard of Gina Miller, though. I expect her to be back.
Yeah, definitely. I can imagine that. So what's your second episode, Tim?
So, second episode. And this was a rare pro-leave guest. We've had a few more on than I thought, actually. I know. And we've had some criticism that we've had more pro-Remainers on. And I think that's probably quite fair. It's not really been for want of trying, but I think it's, I think from a Remain side, people are kind of more willing to come on and talk because they want things to change. From a pro-leave side, you've kind of won already, so therefore there's not necessarily the motivation to come back on into the media and say, you know, argue your case, right? You know, the votes that die is being cast on that one. But this was Alan Hastings, and he's from a UK fishermen's group, and he was just explaining how that the European Union, from his perspective at least, has never been a friend to UK fishermen, how it's decimated the industry in it. And the way he puts it, I took quite a lot of sense from what he was saying, if I'm honest. I mean, it is the, you know, where are the borders struck? Who's allowed to fish in whose waters? And there were, you know, he gave one example about if you have European fishermen coming into British waters, if you like, taking the fish, then going back and then selling them, and then selling them back into Britain. It kind of does seem a little bit of a nonsense, and it's sort of drawing that drawing that link with if you had...
But it's about the labour that goes into it, not the fish. The fish don't belong to anybody, do they? It's about who goes out and who catches them. That's who...
It's the labour, it's the geographical boundaries. It's the geographical boundaries. That's where the issues lie.
But so do UK fishermen not go into EU waters and fish there and then sell it to the EU?
So I think because the UK is an island, then obviously it has fishing-rich waters all around it, so it doesn't necessarily need to go and trawl for miles around. And then they argue also, Alan argues also for different standards on that. And you know, you draw the analogy to, let's say, a foreign farmer coming over and farming your land.
But it's not...
Why? Because the difference between water and land? I think it's a fair analogy to draw.
But no one owns... I don't know, just the concept of owning water seems really strange to me. Because it's like...
It seems strange to you, but I don't think it would seem strange to an awful lot of people, especially fishermen.
No, but even land in the UK, if it's your land, then you've literally bought that off of someone. No one buys, like, a piece of ocean from someone. It's, like, not personal. If anything, it might belong to the country, but then if it belongs to the country and then the country belongs to either you... kind of belongs to the EU. I would understand, like, with land, I get it, because
people would challenge you on the point that the country belongs to the EU.
It did at the time, I mean.
No, I think people would challenge you, like, across the board on that, that Britain has ever belonged to the EU. It's just been part of it.
Yeah, that's what that means. No. I don't mean belong as in owned by it. I mean it belongs as part of all the nations of the EU.
So anyway. I think, I don't think we're going to get anywhere on that one, but I think if people have a listen, then go to, it is episode 73, if you want to hear Alan's views on that.
Okay.
Jen, back over to you.
I will have a listen and then take it up with Alan himself. My third episode was episode 46 with Mr. Martin Glynn, or Dr. Martin, or Doc Martin, as he mentioned at the time. Various synonyms there. He's perhaps one of our most eclectic guests. He's a lecturer / theatre director / children's book author / rapper, which is a great roster of things to be, I think. And
I think he put the first rap on the show, didn't he?
I did, yeah. And I think I found him randomly online, and he'd written something on the University of Birmingham website about how Brexit was having an effect in prisons. Because he works in criminology, and I'd not heard anything about that kind of thing in the mainstream press, because obviously the sort of general notes that are being hit are, as I said earlier, immigration, economy, that kind of stuff. So I just really wanted to have a chat to him about it, and I just wanted to explore some areas and facets of this that no one was really paying attention to. So I think this this episode is part of a couple that we've done about the arts. There was episode 25, which we did with playwright James Graham. More recently, there was episode 87 with Vivi Kalinicu from Art Rabbit. And there was also two episodes where Tim and I went and saw a play about Brexit and then discussed it. And for one, I think I really enjoyed doing all of those episodes because they match up with my own interests. And I think it's really important to discuss how art is taking up Brexit, or how it might be influencing political opinion, and whether there's sort of a responsibility to deal with these issues through art, because art can influence how people think and feel so much. So I think it's been really fascinating to see, it will be really fascinating to see what art will be produced in the future about Brexit, and what piece of art might even influence sort of collective opinion about it, or whether it will. So if that does happen in the future, you'll be very certain that we're going to cover it on here, which should be a good one. And then for the Martin episode in particular, I think I've also found it really special because we actually played one of his songs in the end, which was a first for the podcast. You should have a listen to it. It's really, really cool. And I think it was a fitting first song to play, seeing as the aim of his music is sort of to make academic findings accessible to those who are less privileged and who don't really have the chance or the means to sit in like a lecture hall at a university or to read expensive textbooks. And I think that sort of mirrors what we're trying to do with the podcast, to sort of take all the hierarchical elitist stuff out of information and being informed about this issue, and making it more conversational and more accessible to everybody.
Yeah, what I remember about the Martin Gagarin episode was how he was saying that the prison communities reflect wider society.
Yeah, it's really, they're like a microcosm, he said, of how everything is outside. So if there's a lot of racial tension outside, that will manifest inside as well. So I thought that was, yeah, definitely a really good one to listen to if you're interested in that kind of thing. So, Tim, what's your third
on? Moving on. So, in episode 83, we had Paul Goldsmith, who is a politics teacher from West London. He's been on the show a couple of times, but his first episode, he explains why Britain's never really understood the European Union from its inception. He studied this and he wrote a book on this, and the book's title has completely escaped me right now, but if you Google Paul Goldsmith, European Union, he's also got a blog called Gold Blog, which is a daily blog that would be definitely worth having a read of. He talks about, he goes back through history and plots a course to try and explain why the EU referendum vote happened and it was always going to happen. And it starts as far back as the real reason for the creation of how Europe is as we know it today, which is the European coal and steel community, and it was there to stop future wars after the Second World War. And he talks about with Margaret Thatcher looking on as the French and German leaders of the time, Francois Mitterrand and Helmut Kohl, are holding hands in a ceremony on the blood-stained battlefields of Verdun. And Thatcher's thoughts that this is kind of strange that two old men should be doing this, uses that as a kind of way to encapsulate that Britain, in this case Thatcher, never really understood what it was all about, and so it was never really sold, and so it never, the idea of Europe being a good thing has never really been sold, and so it's never really been entrenched into the British psyche. He cites many other examples in that episode, and there was one other episode which was number 67, which where we had the political researcher Katinka Barich from, I think Katinka was from Berlin, forgive me if I'm wrong on that one, but she's explained that political unity, not the economy, is always, it's going to be Germany's number one priority. So when David Davis goes into negotiations and we constantly try to thrust the trade talks to the top of the agenda, given Germany is only one of 27 other states. However, Sleed probably that in some ways the main player. We need to be really aware that there are many other issues here that matter to the European Union. It's not simply trade.
I think that's probably really evidenced in the fact that their negotiations are going so rockily at the moment, because there's sort of a lack of understanding from both sides, I think, about what the other side actually wants and what their priorities are, because everyone's keeping their cards really close to their chest, and there's not, I don't think there was ever like a very deep understanding between both sides. So yeah, I think that's probably really coming out now in how rocky and how slow the negotiation process is going, don't you think?
That's fair, yeah. Let's move on. What's your final point?
My final episode that I've picked out is a bit of a tooting of my own horn, I suppose. It's episode 80. However, I'm not just saying this because the episode is in a way about me and very personal to me, but also because I think its issues and its topics are very universally applicable, which is evidenced by the fact, I think, that it's also our most listened to episode. And that was basically an episode of you and I talking about how Theresa May's proposed settled status for EU citizens living in the UK was going to affect me personally. And I found it, as I mentioned in that episode as well, a really intimidating topic to tackle, because it's clearly so, so important to people. Otherwise, they wouldn't have listened to it in such high numbers. And I'm really glad we did it, just because I think it's important to cover the fact that the most important sort of quote-unquote casualties of this whole thing are going to be personal and interpersonal. It's going to be people's lives, people's families, and these things won't necessarily be covered in the mainstream, and I don't think this is necessarily something that, you know, politicians always care about. They care about the bigger picture, which is of course important, but I also think it's important to shine a light on the smaller sort of issues. And I think we also did that in episode 89 with Michaela Benson, who talked about British people living in Europe and the very sort of small in a way, but important in the scale of a life issues that these people were facing, just issues about even life and death, really, about healthcare, about how they were going to survive in the places that they'd chosen to call their home. And I think this really reaffirmed our focus on trying to highlight these people's stories as the most important aspect of Brexit, really. I find these stories really hard to find because they don't always make news and people don't always sort of come forward and talk about these issues. So I'd sort of like to make an appeal to our listeners. If Brexit is impacting you or your friends or your family, we'd really love to hear about it. So email us your stories, Facebook us your stories, get them to us however you want. We can even sort of set up a call or record an episode if you'd love to be on the podcast. We just really want to be a platform for the whole range of, you know, experiences that are out there about this issue, and we really need your help for that. So do let us know.
Yeah, you mentioned Michaela Benson there, and Michaela she's been over in the continent doing a Brexit. She runs Brexit Brits Abroad, which is her big research project, and she actually runs her own podcast that would be worth people listening to. Find a Brexit Brits Abroad on Twitter, and you can probably go from there. She's been out there collecting first-hand data, so I know that was another well-listened-to episode. And
just that's the second most popular one.
Yeah, and underlining your point, it's the things that are really hit people personally because when it's personal to you, you're more focused, you have more of an understanding on it, and therefore it resonates more, rather than, like you mentioned there, the bigger picture stuff. Good stuff. Right, and me moving on to my
last episode,
and bringing it right up to date. In the last episode, this is episode 100, in episode 99, we had one of our most controversial guests, and this is the Cardiff Business School Professor Patrick Minford on the show, who has roundedly been booed through much of the left-leaning media, I suppose. And Patrick, or Professor Minford, is adamant that unilateral free trade coming with a, you know, hard Brexit will be a good thing for the British economy to the tune of X billion pounds and X thousand pounds per household in the country. And whilst you can agree or disagree with Patrick's point of view, and many people have disagreed vehemently to the point saying it should never have been given any airtime or oxygen, as you could note perhaps even from our Twitter feed, the point I'd like to make about it, and I touched on it earlier about the confidence of somebody like that coming on and talking, is that it takes me back again to another episode we did, which was when we reviewed a play called The Majority, which was a Scottish playwright, Rob Drummond, that whether you are right or you're wrong, your opinion, to you, that feels exactly the same. So it's not, and this is a point that Rob makes in his play. So when you deliver that opinion, because you so wholeheartedly believe in it, which I think Patrick Minford does in this case. I don't think he's trying to play any sort of political game, you know. I think, you know, he's an academic, which is the stuff he studies. I think he, you know, he firmly believes in this kind of economic view. But it feels the same. So therefore, when people challenge that, you feel quite affronted. I should point out, to redress Patrick's view, we have, in our next episode, we have Monique Ibal from the National Institute of Economic and Social Research on, who is going to look at all the evidence and say that all points to us remaining in the European Union being a good thing. So, Jen, we've done 100 episodes. We could probably do 1,000 episodes on this, but are there any
how negotiations are panning out. It's going to take a while till we eventually get there, so there's time.
If we ever get
there. We could get to 1,000, probably.
Who would you like to have on?
I think, as we've mentioned in previous episodes, I'd really like to have more pro-Leaf people on to get a more sort of diverse range of experiences out there, and to really, when we do talk to these people, to get a very personal view as well, rather than just, I think this because the EU is shit, but maybe something a bit more sort of, yeah, more about why they personally feel this way and what's brought them to feel this way, what are their experiences that have informed this belief. And then, as I mentioned earlier, I do really think that as a whole, yes, it's cool to get on people like Gina Miller, or we've had on like Shashi Tharoor, and that was really interesting to talk to these people, but I do really think that it's the smaller stories and your average person that have probably the most to say about this. And yeah, I'm struggling a bit to somehow find the resources to find these people. So if anyone has any suggestions, as I mentioned, please do let me know how you think we could go about that. Or if you know anyone, let us know. What about you, Tim? Who would you like to get on?
Well, just picking up on that point, I'd like to find people that have changed their mind. So I'd like to see an ardent pro-Leave voter who's now said, oh, I made a massive mistake and I want to stay. Or even vice versa, you know, someone who voted to remain and then is now like, yeah, you know what, leaving's going to be better for us.
Because really
I don't hear too many people shouting, going, I got it wrong.
Yeah, that's the thing. No one's ever wanting to admit that, are they? If you have an opinion, either way, you're like happy to stick to it. But to admit that you've changed your mind about something, that takes a lot of balls.
I'd like to have Nigel Farage on as a guest, you know, one of the most, if not the most influential and successful politician of the past decade, to find out where he wants to move things on, you know, where he wants to go next and what impact he thinks he has. And, you know, I genuinely would be interested to see what he can do or what he wants to do now.
Do you think you'd get proper answers out of him, or would it just be sort of...
No, I think you always get proper answers out of him. I think that's why he's been, you know, so successful as a politician, because he talks straight and he fundamentally believes what he says, and whether you agree with it or you disagree with it, it's easy to understand. And I would also like to have, I'd like to hear from more people from Scotland. We haven't really had many people from Scotland on, if anyone in fact, so that would be good to find out.
We definitely had Robin Munro is Scottish, and we've had her on the podcast a couple of times. She's talked more about, she is a former member of the Institute for Government, a researcher there, and she came on a couple of times and talked more generally, trying to sort of inform ourselves and our listeners about things as they were moving along. But she did also talk a bit about Scotland and her experience with Scottish independence and things like that.
Okay, thank you. I'd still like somebody else on. And I'd also, we've not had anyone from, I'd like somebody on from a country outside of the European Union that feels disaffected and cut off by the European Union and sees it as a protectionist area, and who is looking forward to dealing with Britain when Britain leaves, and feels that there could be some real good bonds and links made there, because there must be those countries and those spokespeople out there. So I would like to hear from that. Who's looking forward to that? Or perhaps even the breakup of the European Union, ultimately. Yeah.
I had another sort of idea for an episode very early on that I really wanted to get on a parent and their child, because so much of what was sort of in the referendum, what we heard about it was, even in my friend circle, that sort of my friends my age, sort of young millennials, would have voted to remain and their parents would have voted to leave, and then that created a lot of tension in the family dynamic, you know, over Christmas dinners and things like that. So I'd really love to get on a parent who voted leave or remain and a child who voted the opposite.
Well, and just stir it up even more.
Not stir it up, but to talk about how that's affected their lives, how they deal with having different political issues, whether they think that's affected, their family dynamic, the way that they relate to each other, whether they understand where the other person's coming from, whether they even try to, or whether they'd like to stick to their guns. I think to an extent it would be bringing it up again, but it might also be, like, therapeutic. Maybe we could have a, you know, Freudian couch situation going on at the podcast. That'd be quite interesting.
Yeah, definitely. And bring a set of boxing gloves as well, just in case.
That makes a great entertainment.
Anecdotally, I've heard of a few of those situations, and they tend to just park it, and politics is off the agenda. They're not allowed to talk about it in a family situation.
That doesn't seem very healthy either. That's why I thought it was so interesting, because there needs to be a way to move forward from this other than blatantly ignoring any kind of political conversation, surely.
You'd hope so. And that's really about it for me and for our 100th episode. Jen, thanks. It's been an absolute pleasure this last century of episodes. It feels like a century.
It does. It really does.
And I guess, you know, here's to the next 100 episodes. And that's it, everybody. Thank you very much for joining us again for the Brexit podcast. You can find us on Facebook and Twitter, or at the website brexitpodcast.com. As we mentioned a few times there in the show, we'd love to hear your views and suggestions for more guests. The Brexit podcast has been brought to you by Jennifer Hahn, Tim Hemming, and Warren Pohl, with the theme music by Kevin MacLeod.